Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Guys,
hey,
what y'all do?
Freezing. God, it's cold outside right now.
I can't take it. So let's talk about why your hairstylist asks for so many questions about your hair history, and why a lot of hairstylists are starting to require you to send hair history before they even make your appointment.
So when we color our hair, even though you might not see that color anymore, or you don't think you see that color anymore, it's still in there. If there is color on my hair down at the bottom on the ends, now my hair is long, that's going to be from like 4 years ago.
And I don't think people realize, I say that to people, I'll be like, you realize this hair down here is probably 5 years old. And they're like, no. And it's like, yeah, I mean,
it grows from your scalp. So the ends of your hair are the oldest part of your hair.
And like people will be like, I quit highlighting my hair a year ago. I don't know why it's still damaged.
Because that's underneath the color that you put on top of there.
You can't take your hair back to a natural state once you have messed with it. Unless it's just a
altered, it's chemically altered.
Unless it's just a temporary fanciful rinse, anything you put on it. A few years ago, I had a girl, did my consultation with her, and I was like, okay, so what's on your hair? Because she had dark brown hair.
Okay.
And she just wanted a little bit of a highlight, kind of like a caramel color.
Yeah.
Should not be hard. So I'm like, okay, what's your hair history? All I have is a brown box color on my hair. You only did this brown box color once? Yes. Okay. Caramel? This is not going to be that hard. That's actually what I would tell you to expect under this appointment.
Right. Oh, and side note, like, we don't ask y'all for box color, like, if you've done box color or if it's at a salon, because we want to shame you about using box color. That is not what that question is about at all.
It's different.
It's just different. Box colors can contain metallic salts, which require a different approach than a salon color that does not contain something that's going to react adversely with our color or with our lightener. Mainly with the lightener. And I mean, like, listen, sis. If you don't tell us true, your hair can, like, literally melt, burn up, smoke the whole nine yards and just be melted by that lightener because of a reaction from the ingredients of that box color that you don't think is in there that you did 8 months ago. Yes, it is.
Oh, yeah. So, my client, I foil her whole head. I check her foil, like, whenever it's time to be pulled. And the word I used for it then and still will today was Ninja Turtle Green.
Oh, yeah. I've also seen highlighter yellow.
Oh, that's a green. So, I started laughing. This is way back on my hair Instagram.
By the way, Ashley laughs when she gets nervous.
Yeah, I laugh when I get nervous. It's just that it starts happening. So, I start laughing, of course, because it's me. And I'm like, hey, what else is on your hair? And she was like, nothing. And I'm like, no, what else is on?
The bleach determined that.
Yes. Like, I was like, I'm going to tell you why I'm asking here in a second, but what else is on here?
Yeah.
And she said, well, I put like a splat blue on there, but I had not lightened my hair, so it didn't take. And so eventually I just
put a little PSA about splat real. I'm going to get on my soapbox here real quick. Stop it.
Stop.
Do not use it. It is not even formulated for hair. It is furniture dye. Don't put it on your head.
And people are like, well, it stays so well.
That's because it's furniture dye.
For a reason. Unless you're never going to do anything else on your hair for like 10 years until that hair is cut off. Don't use that.
The only thing you can do is color your hair black.
I mean, basically, yeah.
That's it. And wait till it's gone. Cut it out. It doesn't lighten out.
Well, and in this situation, the girl had put the brown box color over it.
Yeah.
So then box color has, you know, one removal process.
And again, like we said, it's still under there.
So, yeah, we for forever until it all was lightened out and cut out and gone. She had to just keep kind of getting honestly a brown and just keep doing it and keep doing it. And
yep. I've also seen that horror story happen when people were using Kool-Aid. Do you remember that trend?
My little client, oh my God, she's going to love. Boiling
your hair in Kool-Aid. Please don't do that. Please don't do that.
I cut her hair this week and she asked if I'd like talked about her once in the podcast. And I was like, I don't know. I actually might have.
Here you go, girl.
I'm talking about you. I know she will listen to this, so she's probably smiling big. I have had her for 2 years now, and she put Kool-Aid in the bottom of her hair over 2 years ago, and there's still probably about an inch and a half left.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost out, but we've tried highlighting it out.
I have that leftover from Kool-Aid. Because the girl did red, and so then, of course, it stained her hair pink for eons, and she did it on the underneath side, which, by the way, is the worst freaking part to do, because guess where your longest hair comes from? The bottom down here. And so it takes the longest to grow it off. So there's the reason we ask y'all about your color history is not to shame you about what you've used or what you've done. It's because we genuinely need to know to formulate to get you to where you're going to be and keep your hair intact. Because listen, if your hair's there, we can color it again, sister. If it's not, if we fried it off, which I am not in the business of, then we're SOL. I mean, there are some people where I just have to tell them, like, your hair is not going to be able to do this. Like, it's too far gone. I mean, there are people that I've literally, like, they've came to me with chunks of their hair broken off. You know, so-and-so tried to do this, or I tried to do this at home, and it didn't work out. What can I have? And I'm like, you can have a conditioning treatment. And your natural color match is what you can have.
Olaplex is what you can have, my dude.
So, I mean, you know, like, that. Like, yes, there are some instances where we do have to tell y'all no. But again, we need to know that up front so that we don't go into this and say, yeah, sure, we can give you this. And then end up making a very bad mistake because you either haven't told us or, you know, you were embarrassed by it or whatever. But no, never judgment on what you've put on your hair. It is what it is. You've already done it. That's not something that you can take back. And I get it. Everybody's on a budget. Like, at some point in our lives,
I've done it to myself.
We've used box color too. So, I mean, it is what it is, sister. But we just need to know so we can get you where you want to go.
All right, guys, let's come back to Cleveland. Let's do another Cleveland case.
It is kind of mind-boggling to know that this has happened in Cleveland.
So in saying that, I'll say we're not going to use a ton of last names just to be respectful. But anyway, Randa had never heard about this murder.
I didn't.
This was actually, I was telling her, I was kind of looking around in the Cleveland history group and people were talking about this. And I kind of like remember hearing about it when I was little, but obviously I was like real little. So I don't really remember it. So I started looking into it. And this happened in 1993.
Yes.
So there's not a ton of information on this out there. This is directly from the court transcripts. So this might be kind of a shorter case because we don't have a ton of information on it. But we're going to share with you what we can.
Trigger warning, this episode contains graphic crime.
So on the evening of December 28th, 1993, a woman phoned 911 in Cleveland, Tennessee, and she told the operator that there was a dead man in Park Terrace apartment number 94. So Park Terrace apartment was down South Lee Highway, past like where the old Bachman home used to be. And I'll say that, and some people will be like, where? But if you're from Cleveland,
I went to horse camp there.
Really?
Yeah.
I used to teach swim lessons for the Red Cross, and we did it at the Bachman pool. I always thought it was like a creepy old cool building.
Yeah, it was. It was a really weird building.
I don't know that I ever went inside, though. I don't think I ever did.
I just ride horses a lot.
So
But these, right before you get to the nursery, is where these apartments were. They have since been torn down. Weren't a great place from what I was reading in the group outside of this horrible event. Other things happened. So this unknown woman calls 911 and says, hey, there's a dead man in Park Terrace apartment number 94. Bradley County Sheriff's Office deputies Barry Tharp and Craig Hamilton responded to this call.
Shout out. I knew it was Lars Hare.
As they started up the flight of stairs leading to the apartment, they smelled an odor. So when Deputy Tharp received no response from his knocking, he opened the door, which was, you know, a little bit open, and he saw two bodies, which had been dead for several days. So he just closed the door and secured the premises. He was like, this is not for me right now.
Yeah, let's call in the crime scene.
So Detective Tony Alvarez in the Major Crimes Unit showed up on the scene. He comes in. He finds two bodies in the living room. Mm-hmm. One is a female sitting on the couch, and one is a male slumped over in the floor in front of the couch. The bodies have been there anywhere between about 2 and 7 days.
That seems like an awful big window.
Not just that. If they could smell it walking up the stairs, and this was an apartment building.
Yeah. How did nobody report
that? Like, did other people not smell that also? That's concerning. But 2 and 7 days, that is a very... Because then it would be cold outside, too.
Yeah. And I mean, if the door was open, somebody walking past would see two dead people.
Very, very good point. The male victim had been shot twice in the head, and the female had a gunshot wound to her chest and 3 to her head.
Ooh.
Shell casings from a 25 caliber automatic were found on the floor near the bodies.
Okay.
And they were like, all of these had been shot at very close range. Like, this is heinous and brutal. The television...
So these people were just like shot execution style, just in boom, 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 boom.
Yes, and like the television hadn't been turned off. The entertainment center was ransacked. A partially eaten turkey was still in the oven. A pie was on the counter. Bedroom doors had been ransacked. So like these people were like literally living their lives, and someone came in and shot them both. It's like that's crazy.
That's what happened.
So they were identified as Randall Inslee and his fiancee Diane McKean. Very early on, Randall's ex-wife Ella Inslee and her new boyfriend James Scott McCulley, they became suspects very, very early on. And after talking with state witnesses, Deputy Chief Anthony Benefield drove past a house where somebody was like, hey, I think this is where they're at. So it sounds like pretty early on, people were immediately like, you might want to talk to his ex-wife. So, I mean, pretty quickly they go.
They're already like, hey, talk to her.
Yeah. So, Benefield assumed that they were awake because he was, you know, seeing lights on and movement in the house. So, he called for Captain Chip Bryant to meet him at the residence, you know, to question McCulley. So, pretty quickly, officers Bryant, Petit, Matthews, and Bogus arrived at the house. And the house was located in the city of Cleveland. So, the city of Cleveland dispatched officers to assist. My dad was there, guys.
Buddy, you're called dad.
You'll get to meet him one day, and I can't wait for it because he's awesome. So as officers approached the front porch of the residence, they were met by Mr. Jeffrey, the owner. Chief asked Mr. Jeffrey, are Ellen James inside this house? Mr. Jeffrey was like, no. Do you have a warrant? And they're like, no, we don't have a warrant. Now, I get that, but that's also very suspicious to immediately be like, no, do you have a warrant?
Yeah, that is kind of weird. Would have a couple questions before, do you have a warrant?
Right. Like, why are you looking for James and Ella?
Yeah.
So, he asks him, Jeffrey says, nope, they're not in this house. They're not here. Do you have a warrant? And they're like, no, we don't. When Miss Jeffrey came to the door, they were like, hey, are these suspects in the house? And she said, no, come on in and look. And so when Officer Bryant pushed open a bedroom door, McCulley jumped out the back window.
What?
The officers pursued McCulley, who began firing upon them. The officers returned fire, wounding him in the stomach and shooting his finger.
Which finger was it?
I should have asked.
Dang, I should call my dad right now. We don't know what finger it was.
He said it seems like it was probably his right hand.
So it was, I hope he was left-handed.
He throws down a Crown Royal whiskey bag, you know, the little purple bag that everybody saw him when they were younger. Mm-hmm. Probably used to keep change in. And the officers picked it up. And the bag had a knife, money, and ring that belonged to one of the victims.
Huh.
So he was taken to the hospital. And TJ Jordan, TBI special agent, interviewed him. And when he asked what happened, James said that the police shot him because he had shot at them. Well,
I mean, it's yes. Not entirely wrong.
Well, Agent Brooks Wilkins, we talked about him with Rose Crabtree.
Yep.
He's the one that, you know, got John Patrick Henrietta to confess and solved Rose Crabtree. Brooks Wilkins is a badass.
Really badass.
Yes. He spoke with McCauley at the hospital on January 4th, and before the discussion began, he read him his rights. In a sworn statement, James gave his version of the police shootout and described his activities on the day surrounding the murders. He said that he could not remember what happened on Christmas Day, but on Christmas evening, him and Ella got a room at the Diplomat Motel.
Okay.
He said that they were together the entire night and that he did not get along with the victim, but then, you know, soon after, kind of, Randall was like, okay, Ella and James are fine, we're cool, whatever. We used to not like each other, but we do now.
Okay.
And I've never been to his house. So following this meeting, Agent Jordan interviewed Ella, who was taken into custody by the BCSO by then. Prior to him arriving, Ella was placed in an interview room with a woman named Deputy Darlene Davis. And Davis was just watching over Ella. She wasn't questioning her.
Okay.
Just watching over her.
She's in there with Darlene.
Well, Ella just starts talking to her.
She's got a lot to say.
Yep. She told her that she would always love Randall Inslee. And she went by the apartment and his van was there.
Okay.
They were not charged with the murders until January 11th, 1994. This happened December 28th. By January 11th, these people were already in jail and charged with first-degree murder. So they were in jail. Okay. So a number of other witnesses testified to the various statements that the two had made following the murders. Ella's daughter and Randall's stepdaughter had said that James was super jealous of her stepfather.
Yeah.
She said that her grandfather had asked her to call the company where her stepfather worked and ask for the identity of the beneficiary on his life policy. Randall Inslee had spoken of the policy and whether his father or his child should be listed as the beneficiary. However, Randall's employer indicated that his father was named as the beneficiary. Ella's daughter explained that on Christmas Day, her two small children, Randall's father and Diane's father had gone to the victim's apartment for Christmas dinner. The turkey.
Ah.
After dinner, Randall Inslee had driven the family members back home in their van, and as soon as they arrived home, Ella just showed up. The daughter also talked about the shootout at the Jeffrey residence, and she said that Miss Jeffrey brought her a jacket belonging to Ella, and inside the jacket there were three rings, a black onyx ring, an engagement ring, and a pinky ring. Diane's sister later testified that Diane owned the black onyx ring and a diamond cluster ring. So Ella had Diane's rings. Yes. Mr. Jeffrey, the owner of the home where the shootout occurred, he testified that James had told him about the shootings the day after Christmas and that him and Randall Inslee were talking that night and Randall bent over to sip on some tea and James just shot him.
What?
And when Diane came from the other room, James just shot her too. He also told Mr. Jeffrey that after he shot Randall, Diane pleaded with him not to shoot her. That he threw the murder weapon into Watts Bar and returned to the scene of the murders two or three times to make it look like robbery.
You ain't gonna get it back out of Watts Bar, I'm gonna tell you that much.
Oh, Lord, no. But that he went back a few times to make it look like a robbery. Now, Mr. Jeffrey, he told you that he told Mr. Jeffrey he killed those two people.
When he was going to tell somebody, Mr. Jeffrey? And then the police showed up at Mr. Jeffries' house being like, hey, is James here? And he's like, oh, no. You knew what
he
did.
You didn't think then to say, hey, he told me this.
And if he would kill those other two people in cold blood, Mr. Jeffries, why do you think he wouldn't kill you too?
Hello.
Some people are just better friends than others, I guess.
I have questions.
Chip Bryant later testified that he conducted two voice tests of Ella, and Ella's the one that made the 911 call.
Okay.
She denied it, but even, like, witnesses were
pretty
like,
obvious.
I think that's her voice. Ella testified on her own behalf, saying that about 4 o'clock on Christmas Day, Randall and Diane had came to her house to pick up the kids.
Okay.
And she took a shower. She rented a room at the Diplomat, and it was for some peace and quiet and privacy. But on cross-examination, she said that she had not planned the evening with James, and even though she had registered her room for 2 people. Hmm. Later, they did stay at the motel together. Like, later, they were there for a short period of time before they went back to her house.
Okay.
Randall Inslee was unloading the children when she arrived at 9 p.m., and Ella had said that she stayed at the house for about an hour and then went back to the motel. So if you remember, the daughter said they had all went and ate at right. Randall's house, and then Randall was dropping them off back at home, and then Ella just showed up. So Ella says, well, I just showed up, but then after that, you know, I went to back to the motel room. She said her relationship with Randall was okay. You know, there wasn't really an issue. And that she had kind of been upset about Randall's relationship with Diane at first, but she wasn't bothered about it anymore. And she made the 911 call because James had told her he had killed Randall. She said that her first knowledge of the murder came at the Jeffrey house when James was drinking and told her, I done something bad. I killed Randy. When asked about the rings found in her jacket, at which, you know, they had been turned in, she responded that they had been given to her to James before he told her about the shootings.
None of it's adding up.
No. And just those 2 rings came out of nowhere. What did he just say? You got them for you for Christmas? That just doesn't.
Doesn't. They seem so specific to
you. Yeah. It sounds like she's trying to take herself out of the blame.
Yeah.
And, you know, make him as the bad guy. And Diane's
sister. She had no idea.
Right. Well, Diane's sister had spoke to Diane on Christmas Eve about Ella.
Okay.
And she indicated that Diane had told her Ella had been threatening her and harassing her, and that Ella had called where she lived, and Diane had told her that if she was going to do something, come do it.
She was ready for it. Come get the smoke, little girl.
Yeah. So it sounds like Ella and Diane did not have a good relationship.
No.
And I'd venture to say that Randall and James were probably the same, too. It sounds like 2 people that should have just moved on. You were in new relationships. Like, I don't know why you kept that toxicity going.
Yeah.
But something about you just...
Somebody was out for revenge as well.
That's what this sounds like. A man who worked with Randall for about 8 years. So, I mean, he knew Randall. They worked together for a while. He said that he knew when Randall would, like, give Ella money. Even after they were divorced, he would just give her money. And on one occasion, Randall had loaned Ella the money to buy a car when she had wrecked hers. About 2 weeks before Thanksgiving in 1993, Randall had told him that he had begun, you know, dating Diane.
Yeah.
And when the man was like, well, what about Ella? Randall was like, hell with that bitch.
Ooh! She was bad. Her gravy train stopped. That's what it was. Yeah.
So another coworker and, you know, friend of Randall said that Randall, talking about James, said he hated that SOB. And one night, he actually drove Randall home.
Probably because she kept going back to him and borrowing money and shit.
Probably. And he actually drove Randall home, and Randall told him he did not want anyone to know where he lived. Because before it was over, one of them was going to be dead, meaning him or James. So it sounds... Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like this was
so
like,
they've been planning this.
Yeah, like, well, Randall said this to his coworker. So it sounds like this was...
Like he knew this was coming.
This was a boiling point between them. It sounds like 2 just crazy situations were...
But it sounds like it just kept escalating.
Exactly. Exactly. Nobody would just say, this has gone too far. Like, we need to chill out. Like, just go our separate ways. Let's be cool. Like, it was just building and building. And he saw that it was about to explode at some point. And it sounds like, honestly...
everyone around them saw it was about to explode too. That's the sad situation about this is.
This seems very preventable if y'all just would not go around each other.
Well, Ella's brother had had a conversation with Randall about additional life insurance like 4 months before he died. And Randall was asking if he should put Ella or the children as the beneficiaries. And her brother suggested that he should put it in the children's names. Ella's sister-in-law testified that 2 months before Christmas, James told her that he was planning to kill Randall Inslee for the insurance policy and that he would have to wait a couple months for it to go into effect. So they were telling people this was happening.
Yeah, that is wild.
Openly. James's cousin spoke of a conversation she had with Ella. And during that conversation, Ella had said that Randall had adopted Ella's son and that he was Randall's only heir. And everything that he owned was in the son's name if anything happened to him, including the insurance policy.
Really?
The cousin also spoke to James on the phone Christmas night at like 9 o'clock. And she said that James had called from the diplomat and wanted her and her husband to take James and Ella to Athens. She said she thought she could hear Ella in the background of the conversation. And when she said they would not, you know, take the two to Athens, James called like an hour later with the same request. After the shootout and everything, Ella told the cousin that she threw the gun off the 58 bridge because it had fingerprints all over it. And that she hoped the gun would never be found. The cousin also had the conversation with James after Christmas that he had done something bad and that they would know about it when they saw it on the news. And about 2 days before the shootout, James said that he was not going to jail. After the shootout, she took Ella's jacket to Ella's daughter. And finally, the cousin told on an occasion when Ella was in her home and had the cousin telephone Diane and call her a bitch.
What?
This is all one person's statement.
So that it all... Okay.
Happened before and after the murders, yes.
Okay.
The daughter's boyfriend tested.
And these people never thought to say anything.
Never. Okay. Like they openly talked about being a murder.
Okay.
So the daughter's boyfriend testified that 2 weeks before Christmas, Ella told him, "One day I'll be wearing Diane's rings." Ella warned him that if he told anyone that she said that, she would know who told. And he was also present when the cousin brought Ella's jacket to them. And he had been given the knife that was in the pocket of the jacket.
What the fuck? So, okay. Alrighty.
Mm-hmm. Ella's son testified that between Thanksgiving and Christmas of 1993, he overheard a conversation between Ella and James in which James said, "I'm going to kill Randy." And he also testified that his sister and her boyfriend were present when James's cousin brought Ella the jacket to them. They went through it, the jacket pockets, and they
found... These assholes might as well posted fucking flyers about it.
Yep. They found a pill bottle with the black onyx ring, a gold pinky ring, and a diamond cluster ring. And on cross-examination, he said that James was super dominant over the relationship with Ella. So, James's cousin, we'll say cousin number two.
Okay, another cousin.
Had a conversation with James about Randall. And James told him he didn't like Randall because he was causing trouble between him and Ella. And that he would like to whip Randall Inslee's ass.
Causing trouble between him and Ella's causing trouble between him.
Exactly. Cousin 2 saw James and Ella on Christmas night between 9:30 and 10 at his apartment in Athens. Which is about 34 miles from the Park Terrace apartments.
Is that why he was wanting Athens?
Who gave him the ride to Athens? Cousin said she didn't, so how'd he get
right,
to Athens? So on Christmas night, James gave Cousin 2 an Uncle Henry knife, and Cousin 2 thought that he saw James with two handguns. Before the shootout, James told him he was going to go shooting and would not go back to jail.
He's going to go down shooting and not go back.
And then James,
you're going to jail.
James's aunt was given a heart-shaped ring by Ella a couple days after Christmas and told not to get rid of it. But on December 31st, she called the aunt and told her to get rid of it.
So she was like, "Here, don't get rid of this." And then she was like, "Hey, You never had that.
Yep.
Wow.
Ella Inslee and James Scott McCauley were each convicted on 2 counts of first-degree murder.
Yeah, say so. They told half the country.
They did. James was also convicted of attempted second-degree murder, and Inslee got 2 consecutive life sentences. McCauley was sentenced to life without parole in the first-degree murder and consecutive 30-year sentences in the attempted second-degree murder convictions.
Wow.
Yeah. These two were not masterminds.
Very smart, no.
No.
They definitely weren't ever going to get away with it.
No. God, no. You can't tell everybody when you're going to kill somebody. No. Don't tell anybody. Don't involve anybody in that. That's how people get caught.
Don't do that. Big dum-dums.
Yeah. But that is a Cleveland case about...
But shout out, buddy. Shout out, Barry Tharp.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, Dan.
So, all right. Thanks, guys.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.